they can be tiny, they can be small, and they can be surgically inserted into places where a utility may need support, but doesn't have a lot of capability to go do something new.
Greetings, Earthlings, and welcome back to Earthlings 2.0, the show where we imagine how we can be better versions of ourselves and build a collective future we all actually want to live in. In the tech world, you hear a lot about how great the virtual world is, or it could be once, you know, something like the metaverse moves beyond empty chat rooms. But in the energy sector, virtual power plants are already quite successful. These VPPs, as they're termed, are allowing communities around the globe to create more sustainable and reliable electricity grids, reduce the need for new fossil fuel generation plants and all the emissions that go along with them, and also compensate customers on their electricity bills. Like, who said fighting climate change couldn't be a win-win-win? If anybody said that, I want to know who they are so I can beat them up. Anyway, before we... I just have a little bit of rage for those deniers. I'm sorry. Before we beam up today's guest on our proverbial ship, I'm your host, Lisa Ann Pinkerton. I'm a former environmental science reporter for NPR and PBS, and now the CEO of the award-winning PR firm Technica Communications. I'm also the founder of Women in Clean Tech and Sustainability. And if you've listened to our show before, you'll know that all of us are here at Earthlings 2.0 because we believe everyone has a chance to make a difference on this planet, no matter how small it might seem in the grand scheme of things. In our journey to find our place amongst other do-gooders in the cosmos, this show has opened up opportunities to speak with those people who are pushing the dial back on climate change, the plastics crisis, AI, commercialization of space, how we want to make sure that that doesn't turn into just like a corporate craziness, and, you know, keep this world livable for all of its inhabitants. If possible, we encourage you to join us on our journey. Become a part of our ship. Beam yourself up here by joining our Patreon for $5 a month. When you sign up, you'll have unlimited access to exclusive Earthlings content like extended interviews. I mean, we talk to some of these people for 45, 50 minutes, an hour and a half sometimes, and we cut it down to 30 minutes. So there is a lot of information that is left on the proverbial cutting room floor. So you can listen to these entire interviews if you sign up on Patreon. And you will get a t-shirt once I finish designing it. Seriously, I'm almost there, I promise. Beyond Patreon, we would love to hear your thoughts on the show, so please connect with us on social media. Tell us what you think. If you don't like something, please let us know. We want to hear it. We take feedback as a form of kindness. Also, leave us a review on your podcast app, because that is how new people are going to find us. And as always, thank you to Resource Labs for having us on the network. As you might be aware, electrical grids are basically massive machines that are constantly balancing supply and demand. And the basics of how they function have not really changed since Thomas Edison turned on some of the first electric lights in Manhattan in 1882. Thank you, Gilded Age, for highlighting that piece of history for the masses. I was so excited to see that when I saw that show. And, you know, it's the year 2024, 140 years later. It's not the spinning reserves of fossil fuel plants that are coming online now. It's solar and battery storage, especially in the US, that is going to make up 81% of new electric generation capacity. Okay, fossil fuels out, renewables are in. And this means a whopping 62.8 gigawatts of electric storage is being added to the grid. And most of the time, that storage is going to be idle. It won't be used. On the other side of the equation, most utility grids are still trying to predict when people might use energy, which means if there's surges in demand that they didn't anticipate for, they need to balance that load with something called peaker plants, which are usually natural gas plants. They could be bioplants, or, you know, in some remote locations, they might even be run on petroleum. And all of this is really dirty. But solar and batteries can do the same thing as these peaker plants without all the baggage. That's why VPPs are in and peaker plants are out. VPPs are the new go-to for utilities like the US, Germany, Puerto Rico, Australia, because they can control and aggregate all this load from all these disparate points around a grid and collectively balance load without turning on a peaker plant. And that's how companies like Swell Energy and others keep the power on for utilities without all of those emissions and compensating homeowners at the same time for the privilege of using their devices, all automatically. So that's why our guide on this mission to understand VPPs better is Sarah Mincheski-Delisle, and she's the VP of Government Affairs and Communications at Swell Energy. And before joining Swell, she served as the National Sustainability Director within the Department of Defense and undertook high-ranking roles in energy and environmental policy for the Chief of Naval Operations.
So within the United States, I think this is a topic that comes across our news feeds on a daily basis in one way, shape, or form, or another, regardless of what news feed you tapped into, right? What your algorithm is getting you, right? We have stories about electric retail prices going up. We have stories about electric demand going up. At the same time, we have renewable energy adoption surging across the country, which has another challenge associated with it, in that those renewable energy resources are often intermittent in their power supply. So we have to figure out how to ensure we have the power we need when we need it, not just when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing. We also have incredible government incentives available on the table right now. And so for these four reasons, virtual power plants are really indispensable at this moment in time because they allow for that visibility, that control, that integration. I'll also say that many states are working toward greenhouse gas neutrality goals, and they're taking offline carbon-intensive peaker plants. And so virtual power plants are a tool within that toolkit that utilities can look to enable a transition away from some of the historic generation supplies that they have historically used and move into a cleaner energy future that's reliant upon many of the technologies that customers are already adopting.
So you mentioned a bunch of different types of reasons why virtual power plants are becoming more in vogue. An end customer's perspective, how would they interact with a virtual power plant? And can you give us like an example?
We make the experience of being in a virtual power plant as invisible and seamless as possible. We curate each PV and home battery system to be tailored to that customer's energy profile. And so the system sizing and the utilization is all analyzed in advance of enrolling a customer into a virtual power plant. Ultimately, when a customer is providing services during an event window that's called by a utility, the customer will have no interruption to their normal daily life. Their battery may be providing any number of services back to the grid, but their utilization of energy within the home is not affected.
An event window, these could be because there's maybe some excessive demand on the grid, or there's something happening within the grid system that the utility wants to either reduce power or draw power from the virtual power plant. How does that all work?
Right. So a good example would be peak summer months in the West, where in the months of August, September, October, right, we have the highest electrical loads on our grid throughout the course of the year occur during those months. And so, what the state and utilities are looking for are capacity. They're looking for capacity, right? Where is that energy that they have available to them that they can call upon in those moments where they ultimately need it. Historically, that additional capacity would necessitate the construction of a fossil powered peaker plant, right? So they'd bring on an additional 40 megawatts of power. They'd site it in the region where they need that power. And that's how that additional load would be met in the past. By allowing, you know, this capacity that's sitting inside of people's home to be accessed, it avoids, you know, that additional need to build more generation on the grid. It has the additional benefit of paying those customers for their participation, right? So this is what we think of as a virtuous cycle that can help buy down the cost of what are still very expensive assets, right? Adding solar and battery storage to a home is not an inexpensive proposition still, though, you know, costs can continue to come down, and we anticipate that with supply chain advancements that will continue to be the case. But it's an expensive proposition. And so as we look to what are the incentives that can help make this more affordable, more economical, more accessible to the masses, like certainly virtual power plants are a very exciting and enticing new value stream to bring to the table to allow customers to start earning benefits from the systems that they're placing in their homes without giving up the reliability that they also bring and has been a large reason why early adopters have installed these systems.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense too, because if you're going to spend a lot of money to build an additional fossil fuel generation plant just to cover peak hours in August or something like that, right? So you're not going to use it all the time. You're just going to use it when the grid really needs it. That's a massive investment that then all the ratepayers have to cover, right? It's not like the utility is going to build that and cover the costs themselves, right? They're going to pass all that cost down to ratepayers. Everybody's costs go up. It's an asset that's not used all the time. And there's all these second and third order effects of building fossil fuel generation. Like some people may have to live around that, or it may take up, you know, a greenfield location, or there's all these other reasons why you would not want to continue building these plants, especially when you have all this capacity basically just sitting there, right? Waiting to be utilized. And I wonder, because we hear a lot about, you know, we're going to use more energy in the future. And we also don't want to be building fossil fuel generation plants. We want to be building solar and wind, and that'll all happen. But I wonder how much of that new electricity that's needed can also come from what's stored in a virtual power plant scenario. What are your thoughts on that?
The recent DOE virtual power plant liftoff report references that there's approximately 30 to 60 gigawatts of virtual power plant capacity in the United States today, and that has the potential to triple by the end of the decade. A lot of that number that they cite exists today is in the form of demand response, which is not, you know, this is not a new technology. This is a technology that we've been using for 40 years and through various energy efficiency measures. And so we need to do all of that, right? We need to do all of that and a lot more. And one of the reasons why Swell Energy is very much focused on battery storage is that it truly is a Swiss Army knife as far as resources are concerned. Smart thermostats can't inject power back into the grid. You know, they can help manage a load and pre-cool a home so that it avoids peak hours of the day and reduces use costs. Batteries offer a wealth of various capabilities that are ultimately very much needed in this moment in time of, you know, greater renewable penetration and a desire for greater reliability.
When we're talking about virtual power plants, what states or utilities are running virtual power plants right now, and how do they differ?
If you think about demand response programs and that being one grid service available through a virtual power plant, I would venture to say that all states have virtual power plants operating today. States with more advanced virtual power plant programs and initiatives where they're trying to drive, you know, newer capabilities from these systems include many states in New England, Texas, California, the states in the Pacific Northwest are rapidly developing programs, and those in the Midwest as well have plans. I don't know of any specific programs operating today in the Midwest, but I know that there are legislative propositions and RFPs from utilities out on the street now to build these in the near term.
We talked a lot about the U.S., but are there other countries around the world that have virtual power plants in their territories?
Yeah, so the Australian market is a really a hot market for virtual power plants. This is in part because they have some of the highest per capita rooftop PV adoption rates and have been very quick to pair that rooftop PV with battery storage. They have some of the highest energy consumption rates per capita, and they have utilities that require greater visibility into those assets. And they have very high value for grid services and an established market to measure and pay for those grid services. So one of the grid services that is most highly valued in the Australia market is fast frequency response, which is simply a battery's ability to kind of like infuse very small amounts of power into the line so that they can maintain the appropriate frequency and operate efficiently. So that market is a bit ahead of the United States as far as fast frequency response is concerned. But we're seeing other confined grids like the grid in Hawaii also require that particular grid service of fast frequency response and value it very considerably, which provides really nice incentives back to customers for their participation.
For someone who doesn't understand the intricacies of how electrical utilities work, what would happen or what would be the result of the frequency dropping on a local grid? And like, why would you need to respond to that quickly?
If folks remember back to Texas two winters ago, right? This was a national story about how the shutdown of the natural gas generation facilities resulted in these line losses, and the frequency had dropped below, or it was very near approaching dropping below the required Hertz level for it to be able to function. And so once that happens, there's cascading effects and the entire grid shuts down. And the worst part about those line loss events is the time it takes to recover from those events. So it's a black start event and the entire grid needs to be rebooted. And my understanding is that that can take a month or more. It's no small thing.
So there's a lot of incentive to keep that frequency up.
Right.
Even those of us who work within the energy industry, you know, there's these little nuances of how this massive machine operates, and it all seems to be around this. There's this delicate balance of everything and maintaining that balance. And it's this dance that utilities are doing all the time.
Right.
And they don't always have a lot of visibility, right? They have to predict how humans are going to interact with the grid, and they do their best.
Right. And the independent system operators, of course, at a, like a larger scale than that, coupled with levels of demand that have never been seen before and are only projected to increase astronomically. Really interesting article in the Washington Post this morning about artificial intelligence and clean tech specifically driving very large amounts of load, right? They reference cryptocurrency, and the cryptocurrency element has been covered, I think, very well for years about the new energy demand that it was placing on the grid. But the data centers that are being rapidly built across the country to support AI and the additional factories that are being built for more domestic capabilities in manufacturing are driving load insanely high. At the same time, we have climate-driven weather events that are putting greater strain on systems that haven't been maintained in some parts of the country as well as they should have been for a century. So it's this perfect storm of issues just coming to a head. And This is where I see virtual power plants lending a really elegant, supportive role, right? Because they can be tiny, they can be small, and they can be surgically inserted into places where a utility may need support, but doesn't have a lot of capability to go do something new, right? Because there are many tiny utilities across the country. So there's an option for them. Let's try something small. It doesn't need to be a 5, 10, 20 megawatt project. It can be very, very, very bespoke. But you can also ramp and scale those very quickly. And as you gain confidence and comfort with a particular program, you can grow it over time. You can add to it. You can augment it, right? To the idea that a lot of the technologies that we're using to build these virtual power plants are also changing very quickly. And so we want to design them in a way where we're acknowledging that technology will change and we want to be able to tap into that new technology as it does.
I love that. And you mentioned new technology, some people sort of sitting on the sidelines to invest in distributed resources like solar and wind or solar and batteries, because they don't want to get caught purchasing something and then something even better comes along. So what would you say to folks who are sort of in that limbo, that decision-making point where they want to do it, but they have FOMO around what might come next?
This is a very individual question, Lisa Ann. Part of it is, I suppose you can start small, right? If you are interested in participating in a virtual power plant, but you don't want to make an investment like putting solar and storage on your roof, right? Get a smart plug, right? They're $10. There are programs for smart plugs, right? And that smart plug is able to be seen. You can plug it into a refrigerator. You can plug it into your television or some higher load device. And, you know, it'll turn off your fridge for 2 hours at night when no one's opening the fridge and the fridge will stay cool. And you can help conserve load. You can help save money on your electric bill by using this. But you can also, you know, allow it to be called upon when the grid is very strained. I would say there are things that you can do that are really not a big commitment. If you want to buy a car, maybe the decision-making process is a little bit more challenging. But I will say I've had an EV for 9 years. I've had a few different EVs for 9 years now. And actually, I started with a leased product, which was kind of a nice way to try it on.
And there's thank you for mentioning the smart plug, because I think people forget that those exist. And that is an easy way to start to participate in this new world of virtual power plants that I can only see increasing in popularity, especially once people start to get their hands around how it works and the money that they're able to get back a little bit here and there to offset the costs. Something we haven't touched on is you're doing this non-wires project in Queens. And I think that's going to be a new concept for a lot of people. So can you explain to us the project you're doing in Queens and what does non-wires mean?
Swell was contracted and asked to support Con Edison in developing this particular program that is using residential behind the meter solar and battery storage systems to support the grid in a way that allows Con Edison to avoid upgrading a specific distribution line in a neighborhood in Queens. So transmission and distribution costs are very front and center across the energy industry right now. There are trillions of dollars of need to upgrade the grid to enable greater amounts of renewable energy to be built on the grid. But there are also regular upgrades that are needed on the distribution system, which are the smaller poles and wires that bring power from the high voltage lines that carry power long distances through the transmission system into the neighborhoods. And so this particular project is an alternative for Con Edison to avoid that line upgrade and also avoid building new poles and wires in that particular area where otherwise would be required, save for these other assets. So this is an area of great need, but also high growth. And I think a lot more research and effort is needed on this particular topic itself. Last year, Stanford came out with a study saying that utilities could save billions of dollars a year if they were to use distributed energy resource management system, which is really just the software that's operating a virtual power plant that kind of has the visibility into all of the distributed energy resources, but then has the ability to like tell those resources what to do and when to do it. So by doing that orchestration, right, by being the conductor of all of these thousands, ultimately millions of systems, what does that mean for the poles and wires on the grid? And I think we're very much at like the cusp of that conversation. Much more needs to go into advancing our understanding of how to utilize those resources so that we can facilitate more renewable energy adoption while perhaps building less. So maybe perhaps some of our estimates for the T&D, the transmission and distribution costs, are exacerbated because we haven't done some of that more foundational work on the grid services side.
You got me thinking about line losses and how much energy we could save, really, that we're generating if we were using more distributed resources and sharing energy more locally without having to use the distribution lines as much. We're coming up on time, and so I wanted to ask you, you know, this is Earthlings 2.0. It's a futurology podcast. I always like to ask sort of like, what is your prediction for the evolution of the virtual power plant concept in the next, like, say, 5 to 10 years? What do you think we could expect?
I would expect widespread adoption of virtual power plants. Not just, I think there's going to be a push from customers on both their local and state governments, as well as their utilities, to do more in this space. Technological advancements, no doubt. Additional integration with the grid. A ton more storage expansion. I mean, the storage adoption rates, especially on the residential side, are all projected to go through the roof over the next decade. Greater regulatory support. There's an exciting legislative proposal in the state of California right now, which would require utilities in the state to utilize virtual power plants to meet their resource adequacy requirements through 2035. And it's I've not seen anything like it in the space. And I think legislators are starting to catch on that, you know, some utilities are going to want to do this because they see the value, they see the need, and they see the value opportunity. Other utilities are going to need to be told to do this. And so seeing this type of legislation, I think, is very encouraging. And I would anticipate that we'll see other similar legislation in other states as we go forward.
Vehicle to grid is something that people have been dreaming about for a long, long time. And, you know, eventually, I guess we'll get there. It always seems like we're 5 to 10 years out on that. Do you anticipate the vehicle battery storage component eventually being integrated into the virtual power plant ecosystem?
Yes. I think for now, it's going to involve informed charging decisions. I think the idea and the technology required for cars to be able to export back to the grid is still, like, to your point, like, it's still a ways away. And there are some efficiency challenges on that side of the equation that need to be resolved that, to my knowledge, are not yet resolved. So,
Not to mention the warranty implications and all these other aspects that people
and whether
don't
you live
about.
In a cold climate, hot climate, you know, all these decisions.
Oh, this is great.
Right. But just getting the timing right. I think just getting the timing right of charging can do so much good. I think that should not be understated, right? If we can all charge our cars on days when the state is otherwise exporting our solar power to other states at a negative price, like, there's a lot of good that can come from that.
Earthlings. I love how virtual power plants have the ability to bring real value to both people and utilities, all through basically software. We'll add in the show notes a few things that Sarah mentioned, like that Queen's Non-Wires project, which is pretty cool, and the DOE report that she mentioned about virtual power plants. And, you know, something we didn't get a chance to dive into is how the reduction of gas peaker plants could also mean a reduction in air pollution for people living in disadvantaged communities, because most of the time, these gas peaker plants are located in communities with high percentages of low-income households. And sometimes these communities are already playing life on hard mode. And so it's a pretty cool second-order effect that through a virtual power plant, you can reduce the need for utility to build a new power plant or to turn on one of their existing plants. So it's pretty cool, if you ask me. Our faith in humanity is restored this week by Davis Martin Demaldio. Schoolmates of the 14-year-old from Indonesia thought his fascination with insects was odd until he became famous for it. On a long walk with his dad, he found an unknown and rather large stick bug. He gently collected her and contacted the science collective, the Indonesian Mantis and Phasmid Forum, and asked for their help in identifying it. Turns out he had found a new species of giant stick bug, a female no less, who was also carrying eggs. Davis, along with the researchers who helped him monitor it, named the new insect, I can't believe I'm going to try and say this, Nyctophasma sabson bai. And together they eventually produced a paper about the discovery. Now, that name is in honor of Sobhsonbai III, a ruler who fought the Dutch colonial forces on the island of Timor for much of the 19th century. Just goes to show you, we still have a lot to discover on this beautiful blue-green space flower that we call home.
Hey, listeners. This show is a part of the Resource Labs Network. It's a curated collective of industry leaders who are accelerating the clean energy transition. If you want to find out more, visit us at resourcelabs.co.